pause on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine changes the rollout here in Florida. The Skyway's future could hinge on a hike in the local gas tax. And more witnesses appear before the grand jury investigating the failed sale of JEA. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Get on the line now and join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, a conversation with Emily Salyers of the iconic folk duo The Indigo Girls as they play St. Augustine this spring. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a busy week in the news, we're excited to welcome four all-stars to the show. Nate Monroe of the Florida Times-Union is here. Hi, Nate.
Hi, Melissa.
Good morning. Writer Nakeisha Williams with us once again. Good morning, Nakeisha.
Hi, Melissa. Good morning, Duval.
Good morning, Duval. That's right. And everyone else out there, too. A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics. Hey, A.G.
Hey, I'm closer to fine this morning. Hope you're the same.
Yeah, we're going to be hearing that song later in the hour. And rounding out our fabulous foursome, writer Shelton Hull. Hi, Shelton. Yep, we'll have Shelton in a minute. The perils of social distancing as we try to book this roundtable at the tail end, hopefully, of this pandemic. It's 549-2937 to join the show. Already getting your calls. Lots to get into. We'll go to your calls in a moment, but let's begin with the latest on the vaccination rollout in our area. Dr. Anthony Fauci said Thursday that he hoped the nation would soon be able to resume use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Rare reports of blood clots in just a handful of patients have paused the administration of the J&J shot. Florida put a halt to this vaccine being rolled out earlier this week. The governor himself received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. It hasn't been a major component of the federal vaccination campaign. It accounts for fewer than 4% of the more than 198 million doses that have been administered around the country. However, we've been talking to people at the vaccination sites this week, and they want to get the word out to everyone not to be afraid to be vaccinated with the other products that are available, Pfizer and Moderna. Give us a call as we discuss this, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax, and our Facebook page is open. Nakeisha Williams, let's begin with you. The FEMA-sponsored vaccination site at the Gateway Mall and its hubs have stopped offering the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, although second doses of the Pfizer vaccine will still be administered at these sites, the authorities there say. This doesn't really complicate the vaccination effort in our area too much because there are still plenty of opportunities to be vaccinated with the other products. That said, vaccination leaders, the people working to get as many Americans vaccinated as possible, do have some concern that this could increase vaccine hesitancy among some people. What are your thoughts about that?
I think we knew this was going to happen when all the vaccines came out. There are always risk of side effects in the CDC and the FDA granting emergency authorization and saying that, you know, some of these side effects that some people can experience are not in high numbers and they're not considered to be a big deal. I remember there was a whole issue of some developing Bell's palsy from the Pfizer vaccine early in the pandemic and, you know, other side effects, including the fever, the chills, the fatigue that are common with the second doses of the Pfizer and or Moderna shots. So it's not surprising that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine has a side effect of blood clots that can cause death, which, I mean, we don't want to die. But I think the real issue with the vaccination program and the pausing of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine specifically is that while, and I hate to say this in a crass way, traditional citizens can still get the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, the Johnson & Johnson one-shot vaccine dose was really meant to target homeless and transient populations because they are some of the most vulnerable. They're outside, they're in the air. You know, they could be exposed to COVID-19 much more easily. And, you know, getting that population vaccinated and safe should still be a priority. And so that's where the vaccination program really takes a hit. And so I think that, again, as Dr. Fauci said, it's not going to be weeks. It's going to be days for them to assess And then it goes to, you know, everyone has to make the decision for themselves. Vaccine hesitancy cuts across spectrums, race, political, socioeconomic, whatever. Everybody has to decide for themselves, do I want this vaccine? Do I want a vaccine? Do I want my family to be vaccinated? And be good with their decision. I mean, no one can make you get a shot in your arm. It's recommended, but you have to make the decision for yourself, do your own research, and know whether or not it's something that you feel is right for you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely right. Here is a number, A.G. Gankarski, 7.699 million Floridians have received at least one dose of a vaccine. That number keeps going up, but so do the numbers of case counts, hospitalizations, and deaths in Florida. The death toll from the virus now stands at above 34,000 people. And so, you know, we mention this every day on this program. The pandemic isn't over. That is why when you interview public health experts, they really do see this as a race to get ahead of the virus, to get more shots into more arms.
Right. And this is the tragedy of the Johnson & Johnson pause, as it were. You know, you've got a 1 in a million chance demonstrated right now of this blood clot side effect, which is very serious. But compare that to any pharmaceutical you might see in an ad break on cable news. The side effects for those are critical. They're severe. They have to buy 60-second spots to name them all. They don't tell you what the incidence rate is, but it's definitely more than 1 in a million. When we look at this COVID-19 virus, when we look at what's happening around the world with hospitalizations and stretching of resources to this day, and the fact that we have an effective vaccine, it should be deployed. I mean, that's the reality of it, and I think the FDA and CDC will find their way to do that. But the problem is that for people who are already on the fence about getting the vaccine, this is a tipping point. This thing says, no thanks, I don't want that blood clot. And even though, you know, it might be a male, even though it might be somebody outside the age range in which they're getting demographics, you know, women 18 to 48, you know, it's just too much of a cross to bear. So this is going to have some real deleterious effects in terms of resources, in terms of mass, in terms of herd immunity, which is the mm-hmm. point of all of this. The yeah. point is to end this pandemic, to get the herd immunity so that the people who aren't getting the vaccine, who can't get the vaccine or whatever, it doesn't matter because the rest of us have done our part. This is going to make it harder to get to that goal.
Now, speaking of herd immunity, Nate Monroe this week, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis accused YouTube of censorship. They removed a video that was posted on YouTube featuring the governor and some of his health advisors saying that it spread misinformation. DeSantis has been criticized for taking the medical advice of guys like Scott Atlas and others who have downplayed the importance of mask wearing, particularly among children. And so as the vaccination program hits this hitch, this also happened in Florida this week. Let's be clear, mask wearing does slow the spread of the virus. And that's not up for debate. So it's remarkable to have seen that happen this week. What are your thoughts?
Slow the spread.
Yeah. I mean, I find the governor's fascination with these fringe ideas to just be especially bizarre. I mean, it's kind of tragic that, you know, a lot of the, you know, there is some overlap between people who don't think things like masks work, who also are hesitant to take the vaccine. I mean, like, and just sort of courting and encouraging that sort of group of people, I think, is really dangerous, and it's very unfortunate. You know, the governor just seems completely preoccupied with this political ambition of his to run for president, you know, which I guess means, you know, in some cases, rewriting history. You know, as he talks about masks not working, he also wants to take credit for Florida's COVID experience, which, as we've talked on the show before, included most of the population, 80%+ of the population, under mask mandates. I mean, so holding up Florida as some, you know, example that these fringe ideas are legitimate is just totally flawed.
Shelton Ho, when you look at Florida's record on vaccinations, on case count, on deaths, on hospitalizations, it really is remarkable. I use that word a lot. Maybe I should find a new one. How this has been politicized. Florida is really about in the middle of the pack, depending on how you crunch the numbers when you look at pandemic response. Now, that said, Governor DeSantis, as Nate pointed out, does have higher political aspirations. And this fight with YouTube and also his decision to keep schools open early on, these kinds of things fans of the governor point to as saying he has been vindicated in his pandemic response. And we can expect to see these arguments come up again in a few years when the battle heats up for the Republican nomination for president.
Well, you know, we here in Florida, we politicize everything, and we politicize everything badly. We politicize everything to, as AG said, deleterious effect. That's why we didn't have the capacity to handle this pandemic in the first place. Out of the hundreds of thousands of people who've been killed, we're free to speculate about what percentage might have actually been saved had we as a nation done the things that we knew would be effective in fighting it early on. Mr. DeSantis is in a similar position as Mr. Kemp in Georgia. They both slid through narrowly to win their first governorships. Now come 22, the Democrats have the White House, the House, and the Senate. They're coming at both of those guys with every resource they have. They don't have Donald Trump and the RNC to feed them the cash and to feed them, you know, positive publicity. It's insane that people actually talk about him, and I'm sure he's a nice guy, but to talk about him as a presidential candidate, I'd say it's much more likely that Lenny Curry becomes governor than Ron DeSantis even gets his name on a ballot at any Republican convention the way he's handling this situation. I mean, this is the first time ever that you've seen like men in Florida actually being reluctant to put a needle in their arm regardless of what's in it. And that's because of the right-wing bullying and these negative talking points that have got people putting not only their own lives but the lives of our citizens at risk. If this was about winning, if this was about capitalism and growing our economy, we would have done the right thing. We would have done it quickly. And I'll say, again, in favor of the mayor, we're doing a much, for all the problems we're having in Jacksonville, we're doing a much better job with this here in Northeast Florida than we are in the state in general, and perhaps compared to the nation at large. There's some states, such as, say, Utah, where there's only not even 10% of their population's been dosed up yet. So what is the delay? What's the hurry?
AG, I'm going to guess you might disagree with Shelton's take on Ron DeSantis.
Yeah, Ron DeSantis he's a front runner right now for Republican nomination for president. He's got the best political machine in the game, made $5 million for his political committee last month. Every bit of earned media he gets, he parlays, like 60 minutes. He kept hitting 60 minutes until they said uncle to him. Google, YouTube, he's up against them right now. And he's scoring points with the base, and the base is what it's all about. The 2022 governor's race, you look at the predictions markets, a yes share of Ron DeSantis right now is 85 cents. Nikki Fried, she's down in the teens, and she's the leading Democrat. Others are below her, Val Demings, Charlie Crist, nobody else rates. What that tells me is that Ron DeSantis' 2022 governor's election is basically a homecoming game. It's not a matter of if he wins, but by how much. Could he win by 5? Could he win by 7? That is what people are watching. And until Democrats in the state figure out how to counter message, they're going to be relying on the national media to do their work for them. And you'll get things like that 60-minute hit, which didn't hit at all. I mean, I don't want to know what Governor DeSantis' April fundraising is, but I'll bet you it's north of $10 million. So I think Sheldon's a bit off base there. I appreciate what he's saying.
Well, we'll agree to disagree. You certainly know this guy much better than I do, and he's raising a lot of money. Absolutely. And he's going to need a lot of money because he's going to have a lot of negative attributions coming his way. If he thinks that if Ron DeSantis and the people donating to Ron DeSantis thinks he's got what it takes to stand up to Joe Biden or Kamala Harris or even someone like Gretchen Whitmer, it remains to be seen. We've got all these right wingers running around saying that the virus is some kind of Chinese weaponized hoax. Well, we better hope it's not true, because if Ron DeSantis is president and he handles a national pandemic the way he's handled the pandemic in Florida, there won't be a whole lot of his base left around to vote for him.
It's 549-2937. You can always count on Cullo for commentary on this program, along with a lot of emails and Facebook comments. Here's one from a listener. They say, please mention that there will be no mandatory masks in schools this fall, per the DeSantis administration. JR writes on our Facebook page, it would be nice to have a governor who cares about saving lives through solid science rather than attacking the press, hiding data, and pushing for draconian legislation like HB1. That is the anti-riot bill that is moving through the legislature right now. Okay, it's 549-2937. As we continue to talk about that, I want to get into some other big stories from the week. There is no official bill before officials yet, but the debate is heating up around town over raising the local gas tax by 6 cents a gallon. Now, this new revenue would pay for a slew of infrastructure improvements across this city that most people of good faith can agree are desperately needed. But here's the rub. The controversy stems from the Skyway, the much maligned downtown people mover that for many years critics have said is a white elephant. The Skyway would get nearly $400 million of this gas tax revenue and then would become revamped completely to a system of autonomous vehicles, driverless cars that would be elevated and also on street level to neighborhoods surrounding downtown. We're already getting your calls about that. We'll go to them in a moment. Again, the number to join us, 549-2937. Nate Monroe. Members of the city council, as you've been writing, have expressed concern about this big expense for the Skyway. Can the Jacksonville Transportation Authority get this thing through?
I think they can. I am skeptical that the version of this bill that passes looks exactly as it does today. I think that JTA is going to have to agree to lower its Skyway ask and maybe divvy up some of that money to other projects. Because the Skyway, you can almost divorce the issues about the technology and the vision from the Skyway itself. Is just something that engenders very deep feelings, and they're not positive ones. People just hate the Skyway. It is this tangible example of our failure to plan downtown. And, I just think any plan that's hoping to modernize it, it has to sort of tread lightly. So I do think it's possible JTA will make the sale, but I think they're going to have to be really open to compromising on it.
Yeah, the push from supporters of this has already begun. Nakisha Williams, yesterday on this program, the chair of the board of JTA, Ari Jolly, she called into this show unprompted and gave us a passionate defense of this whole plan, saying that it could be a game changer for this city. The challenge will be selling the city council on this. In this time of recession, when there are so many critical needs across the city, this is a big ask.
It's a huge ask. And I'm going to ask the question, you get this money for the Skyway to revamp it, where is it going? Because right now it doesn't go anywhere that people want to go. Unless you're going to take that thing all the way down to the stadium and Lot J,
and it would go to the stadium. It would go into San Marco, Riverside, UF Health. Those, but with these autonomous vehicles,
with these autonomous vehicles, but I would argue more than we need a revamp of the Skyway and autonomous vehicles, we need the infrastructure repairments that to come to the north side that have been promised since consolidation, the septic tanks, the road repairs, the wells, the electricity. So this is not an issue that is top of mind, at least not for most people who live in Jacksonville. Give the people what they need. The Skyway is a want. It's not a need right now.
Shelton Hall, that's certainly the argument against it, that people need reliable transportation to lots of places around the city. And we took some calls yesterday saying that the money might be better spent making it easier for people to get bus rides to far-flung parts of this community. It's hard if you don't have a car and you get hired for a job on the complete other side of the county. It can be tough to get there easily and efficiently with the bus system that we have.
Sure. Well, you know, the people of this city have had an openly hostile relationship towards mass transit in all of its forms for as long as I can remember. Shutting down the trolleys, the Skyway thing, this should have, all the stuff they're talking about with the Skyway should have been done 10 or 20 years ago. The money was spent, but it ended up not happening. The parts of the north side, we're a large city, a exceptionally large city, and so the challenges with mass transit are perhaps more severe than other places. But, you know, now we've got, you've got Brightline downstate in Florida, you've got the monorails, you've got Amtrak looking to expand. Here we're nickel and diming over a couple of mile extension to this Skyway thing we've had up there for 30 years. The money, as far as the funding for it, the funding is there. The funding, it can be paid for. The funding for the north side can be paid for. All this infrastructure situation that's going on the north side, a lot of that results from the fact that the black leadership in this community can't get on the same page. The left activist community, they're too busy bickering about, like, you know, word games on Facebook than to present a unified front and say, hey, this is a majority Democratic city and we're going to advocate for the things that we need. Why is there such a small percentage of Democrats on the city council right now? If we had that, then maybe we could get that done. If you want, look at Flint, Michigan. It costs $5 billion to fix the water system in Michigan. Any president could send in the Army Corps of Engineers, have that done in a year. Instead, we've been complaining about it for 10 years. That's not a bureaucratic snafu. That's simply poor management on the part of the taxpayers themselves. They pay the taxes. They should be advocating for the things they believe in. There's plenty of room for Skyway, Lot J, you know, fixing the schools, all this other stuff. As far as game changing goes, the only game changer this city has available is if we get a Super Bowl win by the Jaguars. Then maybe we'll get some combined, like, real focused effort at maximizing the profitability of this city.
We can dream, right?
We can dream.
We can dream. A.G. Gankarski, the people that are familiar with this technology, this thing would be called a UTC, or Ultimate Urban Circulator. The people who are fans of this are huge fans. They evangelize about this. Opponents say, let's just tear down the Skyway. City Councilmember Leanna Cumber says she'd rather take the hit of paying about $90 million to tear the thing down and spend the gas tax money on other needs rather than embark on this innovative new transportation tech.
Yeah, and you know, I respect that viewpoint. I mean, whether it's jobs for Jacks or cash for contractors, I mean, it is a big spin, a big price tag, and John Cressman, he used to call this heartburn when he was on council on these situations. But here's the reality. You know, the feds and the state have already chipped in on this UTC program. And right now, money is being printed up like you wouldn't believe. I mean, these infrastructure bills, you know, everything coming through on reconciliation. I mean, it's Biden bucks all through the game. So it would be negligence for Lenny Curry and the administration not to look to tap in on that. I mean, you know, Curry met Kamala Harris and, you know, takes her to some of the places in town that need the most work. Was that coincidence, you know? maybe, maybe not. But, you know, she saw that Jacksonville needs some help. You know, Curry came out and said, you know, I want our troops out, you know, to come home. You know, backing Biden, you know, giving him political cover, and the rest of the Republican Party is saying they want war over there for another century. You know, look at the long game here. If Jacksonville chips in on this, the federal money comes in, the state money comes in, and that's how you get the thing built. But if you try to Al Ferrero this thing and nickel and dime it, you end up, you know, looking like 1985 downtown for another generation and wondering why your kids move to Atlanta or to Miami or to someplace else and why you only see them twice a year.
100%.
All right. Let us know what you think, everyone. Let's begin with Russell in Mandarin. Hi, Russell. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for taking my call. Wow. Your panel started off segueing into Governor DeSantis, and that's basically who I wanted to talk about. But addressing the Skyway is really a big problem. And I've heard great ideas about turning it into an elevated park. Considering the high percentage of pedestrian-involved traffic incidents in Jacksonville, if you gave people a safe place to run and walk, that'd be a big deal downtown. And if you're going to develop downtown, it develops around that, an elevated park. Wow, green.
Yeah, they did that in New York with the High Line. That's right. That has not been brought up in any official channel here, though.
Well, okay. I thought I heard it on your show the other day.
Just someone suggested it, but nobody who has the power to do anything about that has said they want to do it. Yeah.
Well, that sounds like a problem to me. Yeah. Okay. I got that. Now, your panel was addressing Ron DeSantis and his inability to govern the state. And the bill that he and the legislature just passed this week, this anti-amendment, First Amendment bill, is going to turn Florida into the Hong Kong of the United States. That's it. It's a bad thing, and I just can't imagine another state doing it. But, hey, Florida's a good place to start with DeSantis at the head, and he is just the tip of the iceberg. The whole bunch of them down there are all lost with this one.
You're talking about the anti-riot bill. Thank you for that. Yeah, it's sure to be challenged in court. We'll see if it passes the constitutional test, Russell. CJ in Mandarin. Hi, CJ.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for talking about this issue and everything you do, actually.
Thanks.
So, yeah, you're welcome. I would, as a citizen, a taxpayer who would be impacted by this, I would like to see this go to a referendum. I know it doesn't have to. But essentially what this is a reinstitution of the tolls, but instead of like paying it at the tolls, you're just paying it at the pump. This is really going to hurt, low income citizens and even small businesses, because they'll have to end up passing the rise in costs to the customer. And then things like, things we don't think about, like restaurant delivery fees, and everyone's getting delivery, but that will have to go up. We do need infrastructure. I agree with AG that we need to try to push from the infrastructure bill, because I know that the federal government really pays attention to Jacksonville. It's a major hub, and but we also need to get creative on how we raise funds. I mean, the gas tax, I mean, it seems kind of lazy. I mean, there's got to be another way forward, whether it's dealing with development or like a luxury tax or something. But and then one last point is on this, I really don't trust Lenny Curry after JEA and then the secrecy behind Lot J. You know, all this infrastructure, there's going to be a lot of dollars at stake. You're going to have a lot of contracts handed out, a lot of consultants. And I feel that he's lost a lot of credibility to be entrusted with such a monumental amount of money that will shape the city for generations to come. And then one last thing, gas prices are going up. I mean, I saw a New York Times article that said that it could approach $4 a gallon by summer. Do we really want to add that money onto our drivers? People are going to stay home more. They're going to not go out as much. You know, and then also GM is going electric by 2030. And, you know, this is a sort of a short term thing. You know, all the major car manufacturers are going to follow.
So, okay. Yeah.
Let the people decide. Get to a referendum.
And CJ, unfortunately, it won't go to a referendum, although I'm sure a lot of voters would like the chance to do that. Nate Monroe, what about the argument that this gas tax is a regressive tax?
I'm sympathetic to that argument and concept. I think in practice, look, there's no bloodless way to raise revenue. If the mayor had proposed a property tax increase, people would be complaining about landlords passing on the extra cost to low-income renters. If we raised the franchise fee, which is a fee that's attached to electric bills, that is the most regressive revenue option available. Sales taxes, all of it is in some form or fashion going to impact people with limited income. The gas tax, it's not the first revenue source that I might have gone to, but this idea that because we raise the gas tax 6 cents, that in Jacksonville, gas will always be 6 cents higher than it is like in St. Johns County is just flawed. Gas prices, there is a whole mix of factors that go into determining regional gas prices. Local taxes are a small part of it, but this kind of like one-to-one sort of idea that, we're raising the prices in this way, it's just more complicated than that. And I think it's really easy to overstate the impact it's going to have. The caller mentioned that this would be essentially reinstituting the tolls. In concept, the idea that we would be making people who commute to this city to work pay or help pay to maintain that infrastructure is a great concept. Mm-hmm. And so I actually don't view that as the worst thing. I think part of the argument for the gas tax is that it does require people who use the actual infrastructure to help pay to maintain it. So again, I am sympathetic to this. To this argument and concept. I am sensitive to the idea that there are income-limited people, but there is no option to raise revenue that just does not touch low-income residents. It just doesn't exist.
Yeah, no painless way. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, Matt at the beaches. Hi, Matt.
Hey there, Melissa. Thanks for having me today.
Sure.
This is where, and I think we're headed as a city in the right direction with the resiliency, and I'm not sure if they're going to be a resilience and sustainability officer, but this is where really a deep analysis.
Yeah, they are hiring someone like that. Yeah, go ahead.
And the analysis of a demolition plan for $90 million on the Skyway, a simple, true baseline sustainable analysis of economics against demolition could prove that we could save even more and not spend that kind of money to demolish the Skyway. But in advance of that, we need to be looking ahead 20, 50 years to our public transportation system and not try and retrofit something that's 40 years old. And we need to really accommodate what's going to be coming forth, not what we already have, and plan towards an electrified future that we can truly understand the infrastructure and begin to build that structural utility foundation now instead of waiting until 20 years of planning that we're so, privy to doing here in Jacksonville.
Right. Thank you, Matt. You're absolutely right. We do need to be thinking much bigger, I think, frankly, when it comes to planning for resiliency and sustainability in this coastal city, which is so vulnerable. We need to be thinking big picture on not just public transportation, but a host of problems that Jacksonville's going to face. By the way, Shelton, here's an email from the Reverend Greg Kaufman. I hope the Emerald Trail and Hogan's and McCoy's Creek projects led by Groundwork Jacksonville receive some funds from the proposed gas tax. Improving public parks for pedestrian and bicycle transportation is a healthy goal. So lots of people would like a bit of this money. Shelton.
Yes, and those are wonderful things. I think that whole Emerald Trail thing in particular looks great, and they deserve to have all the help and support they can possibly get for that, as well as the increased bicycle traffic and things like that. The as to the regressive tax on the gas tax, in a sense it is, but at the same time, you know, this state and particularly this city has always been built and organized specifically to maximize drive time. You know, that's why we're so big. That's why mass transit is in the state that it's in. We want people to drive. We've got gas station owners, car dealers, concrete companies, barricade companies, you know, and then all the jobs that goes along with that. We're running out of oil. We're running out of, like, not running out, but, you know, this is a natural resource and it's finite. And we are paying a price for this, whether it's, you know, overseas entanglements or whether it's, you know, earthquakes caused by fracking or, you know, whether it's, you know, pollution in the air. We do have high gas prices right now, but, you know, the last time we had low gas prices, we had that $2 gas, we had that $2.50 gas. And if you like that, say thanks to Jared Kushner. We know what happened. We know what we had to do to get those low gas prices. We know what we've had to do as a country traditionally to get those low gas prices. And we know the price that's been paid for that. So, you know, yeah, go ahead, tax the gas, you know, tax. I mean, I don't drive, but, you know, I'll buy a car and I'll, you know, you can tax my gas too, if this helps make the city better.
We have jammed lines as we discuss this. Let's go to Jane in Ponte Vedra. Hi, Jane. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for this great discussion. I think that everybody on this panel has great ideas, but my biggest concern is we're not thinking about who's going to live downtown, the climate crisis, and that it's going to be younger people. If we think 40 years ahead or go back to after World War II when we had recovery from the war, this is the point that we are at in this country, and we need to invest in the younger people for the future. They're not going to drive. They're going to want to have public transportation. They're going to live downtown. And if we want Jacksonville to continue to grow, we have to think much bigger than they are saying today.
Thank you for that, Jane. Nikisha.
Yes.
Do you agree with that?
I think that has a lot to do with it, because Jacksonville continues to make lists where it says that we're one of the greatest places for young people and college graduates to move to start their careers. There's a low cost of living. There's trying to be a tech boom in Florida that may extend to Jacksonville. We've got a lot of open space and a lot of industries that are thinking that they can come and start up here. So I do think that's a valid question and concern about who's going to live downtown. But it also goes to who lives downtown now, because there's been a push to build up the downtown living area and the residents who live there and make that an actual neighborhood where people live and work and play and can eventually go to a grocery store. So all of that works together in deciding our infrastructure and where the money goes from this proposed gas tax, be it the skyway, be it the roads, be it a mass transit system that we expand, all goes into planning for the future of Jacksonville. You can't make decisions in a vacuum. You have to think about what's going to happen for the generation who's not here yet.
Lots of comments on Facebook. Melissa says, I'd love to use the Skyway with my kids. It drops off from San Marco by Mosh to the library downtown. The major problem for our use is the safety concern. Laura writes, here's a thought. The city should come up with a system of splitting this too large city into boroughs, allowing independence for each large neighborhood like New York City. That way, taxpayers would pay for the infrastructure they use, she says. Here is an email from Mark at Mayport Naval Station. An autonomous skyway is just begging for some late night risky business. Oh, Mark, you're dating yourself. I remember that movie too. Let's go to Paul. He's downtown. Hi, Paul. Good morning. Go ahead, Paul. You're on the air. Okay. Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
Having me. So I was commenting, I wanted to mention that I'm originally from Tampa. I've been living in Jacksonville for, I want to say, about 7 years, and I've never noticed a very slow developing city. And our main focus on the downtown area, honestly, I don't think we should be doing that. I think we should be similar to what one of the callers had mentioned, trying to focus more on the outskirts of Jacksonville and making it more interconnected, and then focusing on the downtown area, because it's getting to a point where there's not much to offer in the downtown area versus you have all these other communities that have something to offer that can eventually lead to what Mayor Curry wants to the downtown area to be. So rather than, oh, hey, let's tear down the Hart Bridge and build something there, no, let's think about other stuff in our surrounding areas. Like the Springfield area, I think that's one of the most beautiful areas that we can revamp and make it better, so that way the downtown area can also move on up instead of just spending $90 million on tearing down the Skyway or $12 million on some really fancy grass.
Yeah, that is some fancy grass, Paul. You're right about that. That grass cost a lot. Okay, let's take one more call on this, and then we'll move on. Bill on the south side. Bill, go ahead.
Yeah, I think just about all levels of government make a horrible mistake by not engaging the public more with social media and so forth and so on. If people know what the benefits of these different ideas and where our tax dollars are going, let's take the people mover, for instance, the autonomous people mover. How many people will it actually move? What's it going to cost to maintain it? What kind of benefit will it bring the city? And if you don't listen to your show or you don't become engaged out of your own life struggles somehow to pay attention, I think they should reach out through social media, all different levels of social media, and get feedback and just explain themselves better. And there may be a reason why they don't want to do that.
Thank you, Bill.
That's a little scary.
Yeah. I hear you, Bill. AG, you know, the school system sold the half-cent sales tax in this way. They got the public to buy in. Does JTA need to do the same? Really market this to the public?
If they've got the votes, they don't need to. I mean, you know, JTA isn't like hashing this stuff out of nowhere. The UTC Skyway discussions have been years and years in the making. There have been stories. There have been reports. I mean, if you want to lay blame, don't lay blame with JTA for not messaging. Lay blame with corporate media for focusing on things that are less relevant than civic infrastructure because they need clicks or because they need views or because they need to win in sweeps. You know, when
you're talking about local TV,
when you watch restaurant report segments or whatever, you know, think, well, could I have been watching something about the Skyway instead? You know, think in terms of the public good, and that's a programming decision. But I think JTA has kind of made their case, and if they can get through council, that's the ball game, and that's Sixth Sense, and that brings Duval in pair with a lot of other counties.
We are almost out of time, but I want to make note of a few other notes from the week. The federal grand jury met again, meeting in Jacksonville, heard testimony from a retired city hall auditor who blew the whistle a few years ago on JEA's bonus plan that was part of its failed campaign to privatize. That happened. We'll continue to watch that story. Congrats to Rebold grad Renia Davis. She became the highest drafted local player when she was selected ninth overall by the Minnesota Lynx in Thursday's WNBA draft, the highest spot in history for any Northeast Florida basketball player, male or female. Also, the city council voted Tuesday to add baseball legend Hank Aaron's name to a local ballpark. Hammer and Hank played for one season for the Jacksonville Braves at J.P. Small Park. The new name of the park is Henry L. Aaron Field at J.P. Small Memorial Stadium. We are almost out of time. Let's do a quick lightning round. Sheldon Hull, you have a walk. Oh, what a sound effect today. Thanks for that, Brady Corum, our director this morning. Sheldon, you have a walking tour coming up.
Yeah, that's right. My friend Gary Sass at Adlib Tours, he does the downtown walking tours and the tours of the library and the tunnels and such. We're doing a thing tonight called Legends, Liars, and Loggers. We start at Bold City at 7 p.m. It's basically a little historic walking tour of the downtown area, and we're going to stop at different bars along the way for libations. Gary's got stories about every square inch of the area.
Nice. Okay.
And if he tells a lie, you get a free beer.
Oh, excellent. Nikisha, anything on your radar?
Yeah, I went to the Kummer Museum's exhibition of the new Moholy exhibit, Hail the Dark Lioness. It opened yesterday. I got a preview on Wednesday. It's a beautiful exhibit of this non-binary photographer. It runs until June 20th at the Comer. It's the last stop for this exhibit anywhere.
Check it
in
out, everyone.
So, please go.
Yeah, not to cut you off. We're tight on time. Nate Monroe.
Hey, my colleague Emily Block is covering a joint city council school board meeting this morning, and demonstrators are out in front of City Hall talking about the Confederate school names.
Which sure, yeah, that continues to be hot. A.G. Gankarski.
State budget talks starting to heat up this weekend with discussions in committees in House and Senate, and Ron DeSantis looks to be having a campaign event in West Palm Beach today. Will Donald Trump be there? That's something that's been teased, and I'm watching to see if it actually happens.
Thank you, all four of you, Nate Monroe, A.G. Gankarski, Nikisha Williams, Shelton Hall. So good to have you on the show. Have a great weekend.
You too, Melissa.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thanks, everyone.
Happy weekend.
In a moment, Emily Saliers, one half of the iconic folk duo The Indigo Girls, joins us on the band's long-running success and their upcoming concert in St. Augustine. That's next.
Trip back to the age of dinosaurs, calculating how many T-Rexes roamed the Earth. There were billions.
I believe that Manhattan is about 23 square miles, so there'd be about one T-Rex in the area of Manhattan.
Plus a flying stork-like reptile with the neck of a giraffe.
They're kind of like dragons from deep time.
All on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
The latest on the decision to hit pause on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
Boy, those people there, they're looking at that really carefully. And when they say something's safe, you can believe it's safe.
And days of protests follow the deadly police shooting of Dante Wright. More on the Friday News Roundup. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. The iconic folk duo Indigo Girls plays the amp in St. Augustine next month. I spoke with one half of the duo, singer-songwriter Emily Saliers, about the band's long-running success. Take a listen. Hi, Emily. So good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I've been a longtime fan of the Indigo Girls, so it's really a pleasure to get to speak to you and talk about your upcoming show in May in St. Augustine. What is so cool is you're going to be performing a lot of the hits that fans love, but in recent years, you've been doing this interesting new work, performing with symphonies across America, and you put all of that work into a live album. So will we be treated to some of this kind of symphonic collaboration when you perform in St. Augustine?
Well, I wish we could do both at the same time, but we can't.
Okay.
Those symphony shows, it's kind of like its own special thing, and we have all the charts written. We hired a composer, and they get sent to different symphonies in different cities that are interested in having those concerts. So, and then we go in and do a whole day of, not a whole day, actually, a couple hours of rehearsal, then we take a break, and then it's showtime. So it's a different thing. I wish we could present it at the St. Augustine at the same time.
Yeah, but still lots in store for fans. You and your bandmate, Amy Ray, the way your voices blend together is really something magical. How did you two come together as a group, and how have you managed to stay together all these years?
We met each other in elementary school.
Really?
So, yes. So 9 and 10 years old, she had, I guess, was just starting to play guitar, and I already played guitar. I had a little seventh grade band called the Blue Skies, and we used to play in the cafeteria in elementary school. So she became aware of that, and then we ended up going to the same high school, and we joined the chorus together. And when we joined the chorus, we became like fast friends. And I knew she played guitar, and she knew I did, and we were both burgeoning songwriters. So I just went to her house. We started learning songs together, and instantaneously, it was so much fun, and there was such a clicking.
Mm-hmm.
And her voice was lower, and mine was higher, and she was a rock and roll strummer, and I was more of a picker. And immediately, it just gelled. It wasn't like, oh, we're going to form a band, and this is what we're doing for the rest of our lives. But immediately, we were simpatico, and then we just took it from there, step by step, gig by gig, fake ID by fake ID.
I needed them when you were first starting out, too. We don't need them anymore, that's kind of how it goes. But, you know, you have fans of all generations, not just people in my demo, because you really have produced timeless music, the two of you, over the years. I say that as a fan. You really have.
Well, thanks for that. I mean, I think that Amy and I, we're really not, there is no artifice to our work or our presentation as women, as queer people. And we write songs, obviously, through our own lens. But we're observers of life and art and struggle. And so we just write about things that I think the people who follow us, they're sort of universal topics of human dignity and value and civil rights and justice struggles and things that no matter what generation you are from, you can hook into something if that's the kind of person you are and you think about those same things. So,
mm-hmm.
And I think the fact that we're two different, very different people, personalities. We write differently. Our music is different from each other. I think it's sort of like it gives it a little bit more of like, here's something for everybody in a way. If you dig into this kind of stuff or this kind of stuff, we sort of cover more bases than if we were two women doing the same kind of music.
Well, it's great to speak with you and have a great time. We're looking forward to the concert. It's the Indigo Girls, Sunday, May 30th, 7 o'clock at the Amp in St. Augustine. Tickets on sale now. Emily Saliers, one half of the Indigo Girls. Thanks so much.
Melissa, thank you. I can't even believe we get to play live at a beautiful St. Augustine. So thank you for having me, and we can't wait to get there.
And we'll close with some of the most beautiful harmonies you will ever hear. Here's Closer to Fine, the Indigo Girls. Enjoy. Have a great weekend.
Maybe give me insight between black and white. And the best thing you ever done for me is to help me take my life less seriously. It's only life after all. Yeah. Well, darkness has a hunger that's insatiable, and lightness has a call that's hard to hear. And I wrap my fear around me like a blanket. I sail my ship of safety till I sank it. I'm crawling on your shores. And I went to the doctor, I went to the mountains, I looked to the children, I drank from the fountains. There's more than one answer to these questions, pointing me in a crooked line. And the less I seek my source for some definitive, closer I am to find. Yeah, closer I am to find. Yeah. And I went to see the doctor of philosophy, with a poster of Rasputin and a beer down to his knee. He never did marry or see a big great movie. He graded my performance. He said he could see through me. I spent 4 years prostrate to the higher mind. Got my paper and I was free. And I went to the doctor. I went to the mountains. I looked to the children. I drank from the fountains. There's more than one answer to these questions, pointing me in a crooked line. And the less I seek my source for some definitive, closer I am. Twice as cloudy as I'd been the night before, and I went in seeking clarity. I went to the doctor, I went to the mountains, I looked to the children, I drank from the fountain.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.